and welcome to another episode of the Sinwave podcast. This is the fifth episode and we're back after a long time as we had our exam season and the summer break. So it's nice to talk to you again, and we're here to talk about a variety of topics today. But first of all, let's start on updates for the team.
So updates for the team, we had me, George and Nico go participate in a summer lab at the Mazumdar Shaw Advanced Research Center at the University of Glasgow with the help of our PI, Dr. Julian, and our lovely supervisor, Basha. We were able to undertake a couple of lab experiments to understand basic lab protocols and establish a foundation for our projects that we're going to be working on this academic year. Hopefully by the end of this academic year, we will have a working prototype for our idea.
Yeah, and as for the lab work, if you're interested in the details, keep an eye out for future episode, as we want to make an episode talking about the basics of transforming bacterial cells with new DNA, basically basic level genetic modification. So if you're interested in this, yeah, keep an eye out. On another note, main event, September is Alzheimer's month, and it's something that is really important and we will discuss just now. But first, let's get a sentence by Nicholas about what is Alzheimer's month.
So according to the Alzheimer's Disease International Group, they say that September is World Alzheimer's Month, an international campaign to raise dementia awareness and challenge stigma. Each year, Alzheimer and dementia associations, alongside all those involved in the treatment, care and support of people living with dementia from around the world, unite to organise advocacy and information provision events, as well as memory walks and fundraising days.
From that, what you can take as a listener is that you can keep an eye out for any local events, especially memory walks and fundraising days, which are accessible to the general public by any association. What ADI is, Alzheimer's Disease International, it's a federation of many dementia and Alzheimer's association. So many of them are going to be hosting events this month to raise awareness about dementia. And actually this year's campaign theme is two phrases: ask about dementia, ask about Alzheimer's. And if you want to find any content, any posts related to this campaign, you can just use the hashtags. Again, hashtag ask about dementia, hashtag ask about Alzheimer's, where you'll find posts with interviews, events, frequently asked questions. And I think any association who's going to post something about this campaign, they're going to use these hashtags. But let's go deeper into the theme of this year's campaign. What is Ask About Dementia? What is Ask About Alzheimer? And why is it important? So,
I think it's important because it is at most needed that we change the stigma around Alzheimer's and dementia in general. You know, lots of people consider people with dementia unable to continue with work or unable to live by themselves. But I think it's important that we start off by giving a definition to what stigma and disability is. So Dementia UK has a great definition where they say stigma is a negative or unfair belief based on a stereotype about a person, such as their age, race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or disability. And to relate it to dementia, they say people with dementia cannot live independently, and which is a common stigma. Additionally, discrimination is unfair treatment that results from the negative stereotype. For example, the person's performance at work may be called into question. So if a person was to be diagnosed with dementia, maybe their, you know, ability to work might be called into question when they could just be a fully functioning member of society, right?
Yeah, and this is also causes another problem, which is the it lengthens the barrier of diagnosis, basically, because people, due to this stigma and this discrimination, they're afraid to get diagnosed. And this is a big problem, because if you're not diagnosed, you can't even get the proper treatment. But this also leads us to another misconception about the disease, talking about treatment and diagnosis, that it's a natural part of aging. It is not a natural part of aging. And it's important to make this statement. But why? So by saying that dementia is a natural part of aging, you are undermining the fact that it's something that needs to be fought, and it's like thinking of that it will inevitably happen to you or your loved ones. Whereas if you recognize that it is not a natural part of aging, then governments and people, if it's a known fact, this thing, can focus on creating pathways, creating plans, and
overall societal changes in general to kind of support people with dementia and people with Alzheimer's specifically. As we had mentioned in our previous episode, you know, environmental factors play a huge role in the progression of the disease, right? So keeping a healthy diet, having plenty of places to have cognitive stimulation, having
getting a good night's sleep.
There's quite a lot of different environmental factors that play a role into Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and by having a pathway, first of all, to prevent it, and secondly, upon getting the diagnosis, to know what you have to do, what treatments you can get, what's available to you, people can be prepared and supported. And another statement by ADI is that when people with dementia and their families are well prepared and supported, feelings of shock, anger, and grief are balanced by a sense of reassurance and empowerment, which of course, the societal support is a crucial factor in either preventing or part of the rehabilitation part of dealing with Alzheimer's. So as an ending point to this misconception about it being a natural part of aging, 80% of the public and 65% of healthcare professionals still wrongly believe that dementia is a normal part of aging. Hence, this is why when you see such a large portion of the population having such a misconception, even professionals that maybe are not specialized with dementia, this is why ask about dementia and ask about Alzheimer's becomes very important. When you don't treat it as something that needs to be addressed, and when you're not thinking that the more I know, the better I can correspond to someone I know or even myself having to go through this, the better it gets. So that's why people should have a mindset that allows them to gain more knowledge instead of avoiding it.
That's the key point for our project itself. So with early diagnosis, we hope to shift the stigma so that there is more things set in place to support people with Alzheimer's and dementia. You know, they don't have to go straight to the pharmaceutical solutions. They can always take their environmental solutions, you know, rehabilitation. I think there's a lot of points brought up in the last episode on what could be brought upon your lifestyle to, you know, make it better.
Factors.
Moving on to the next topic.
We're going to talk about current and emerging treatments for neurodegenerative disease with a focus on Alzheimer's disease. So, let's start with what's already available on the market. We're going to start talking about symptomatic treatments. But what does this mean? This means, well, a symptomatic treatment is a kind of treatment that helps manage the symptoms of a disease rather than affect the progression of the disease itself. So you can expect the use of these drugs when people already have mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease, because that's when the symptoms show up. Let's start with the first case, cholesterase inhibitor drugs like donepezil, rilastigmine, and galantamine. So these are most commonly used for mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease, and what they do is they boost acetylcholine. But how do they boost it?
So cholinesterase inhibitors, the way they work is that they reduce or control some of the cognitive and behavioral symptoms, and they do that by preventing the breakdown of acetylcholine.
So with less breakdown of acetylcholine, there is a boost of acetylcholine, which is important because acetylcholine is one of the main neurotransmitters in the peripheral and central nervous systems, which would help improve the cognitive memory and thinking of people with Alzheimer's disease, in general the cognitive ability. And now we can talk about another one, memantine, which is for moderate to severe dementia. This is basically an NMDA receptor antagonist, which just helps with improving the memory retention abilities of someone who has Alzheimer's disease.
So the way it works is that it regulates glutamate, which is basically a hormone that is, or I don't think it's a hormone, I think it's a neurotransmitter, that it leads to brain cell death. So by regulating the amount that's expressed in the brain, it the drug regulates the amount of brain cell death and it prevents brain cell death. They work differently to the cholinesterase inhibitors. So the two types of drugs are usually prescribed together.
Yep. So these are two examples of symptomatic treatments. But what about current non-pharmacological options that don't use drugs or substances? There are many kinds of rehabilitation and therapies. And if you want to learn more in general about this, Alzheimer's Disease International, the federation we talked about previously, just released their 2025 report on rehabilitation for dementia and Alzheimer's disease, so you could check this out. But about some non-rehabilitation methods, there is cognitive stimulation therapy. Cognitive stimulation therapy is for individuals, again, with mild to moderate dementia, and it's used to help individuals maintain their independent lifestyle by improving their communication skills, their socializing skills, but also their cognitive ability, but without the use of drugs.
So just reading through NHS's documents for what they have when it comes to the therapy, they've highlighted that this is a very cost-effective method of treating patients with Alzheimer's. And the way it's structured is that it has 14 sessions of 45-minute group therapy sessions. And the sessions run twice a week over 7 weeks. Now, the way that they structure it is that it will have a set format where they have a warm-up activity, a song, and then a reality orientation board at the beginning of every session. And this is to give the information about the group, details including date, time, place, and weather. So members can give their group a name, and the sessions cover a range of activities to stimulate thinking, memory, and to connect with others, such as through discussing current news stories, listening to music, playing word games, doing a practical activity such as baking. So these are all different things that help keep their mind engaged and also lets them be in a social environment where they can express their views and work with each other, so that they don't feel like, you know, they've stopped being members of the society altogether. There is still support there.
And of course, that's interesting that they do that, because it has been said that keeping your brain active, especially in this older age range, is very important, not only to help our loved ones with dementia or Alzheimer's to retain their skills, but also to potentially help prevent the disease.
I think it's quite good that this has shown, like, you know, it helps keep that cognitive stimulation, because if it is cost effective with earlier detection coming into the market, we could improve the support for sessions like this around the globe, especially focused in the UK, because it's something that is a very prominent problem that we're trying to solve. And if there is infrastructure in place and, you know, all the funding required to get these things going, it would be very beneficial for the patients here.
Yeah, these are all societal factors and lifestyle factors that could be improved if a more intensive focus was placed on early stage prevention rather than just late stage treatment. But yeah, the non-pharmacological side of treatment is very interesting, and there are other types of therapy like reminiscence therapy and physical exercise that could also help patients improve. Now, we can move into emerging therapies.
So to talk about emerging therapies, there is a team from China that has released a drug called oligomenate, which is basically a seaweed derived It's sodium oligominate, which is a marine-derived oligosaccharide. So it's just the, I think, compound that they derived from the seaweed. And it's shown to reduce neuroinflammation and bring back the bacteria in the gut. So the way this works is that it's administered orally. It enters the gut, and then it resets the bacteria found inside the gut. So when they bring this balance back to the bacteria, what the mechanism is currently is the bacteria in your gut make metabolites, which are quite harmful once they pass the blood-brain barrier. And once they reach the brain, that's when, you know, you have aggregation of the amyloid plaques and stuff like that. So by resetting the bacteria, they reduce the amount of metabolites that's being produced. But also once this compound, so the compound is actually called GV971, so that's sodium oligominate. Once that passes the barrier, it actually goes into the brain and breaks down the plaques. So it breaks it down into non-toxic monomers, which then can be passed, you know, rather than it forming into plaques and continuing the progression of the drug. And I think they've just finished phase 3 of their clinical trials, and I think they're looking to go into phase 4 now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you see the connection again with the gut microbiome, the gut-brain axis, that is shown to affect, like, the what's happening in the gut, it reflects what's happening in the brain. But yeah, let's move to another exciting emerging generation of drugs, the disease-modifying drugs. So what is a disease-modifying drug? Unlike the symptomatic treatments, a disease-modifying drug is, as the name suggests, a drug that tries to modify the process in which the disease takes place. So for AD, Alzheimer's disease drugs, what this would mean is to slow down the progression of the disease. So not just help the patient manage with the symptoms, but actually slow down the process of neurodegeneration, which is very important and something new. There's currently a big trio of monoclonal antibody drugs, with aducanumab being the first one to get FDA approved in 2021. And really interesting and exciting new one is donanemab by Eli Lilly. How this works is that it binds to form amyloid beta plaques with the intention to remove them. So this is how it modifies the progression of the disease. Instead of fighting the symptoms, it actually removes the plaques. In a large phase 3 trial by Trailblazer, it was proved that there's a large slowdown of cognitive decline compared to the placebo. And another notable drug in this category is lecanemab, which again is an amyloid targeting antibody. But so there is a concern with this type of drugs. The acronym is ARIA, but it means amyloid-related imaging abnormalities. And there has been phase 4, which is post-marketing research on the effect of these amyloid targeting drugs on the brain, on the long-term safety of them.
I think we should explain what ARIA is. For just the basic covering it, it's temporary swelling in areas of the brain that usually resolve over time, and they may be accompanied by small spots of bleeding in or on the surface of the brain. Now, the FDA has done, you know, their extensive regulations and making sure that it's not something that is, you know, prone to happen to any patients. They have also issued a warning for certain carriers of a gene where they seem to be more prone to ARIA, and it is advised to all doctors that administer this drug that they do the testing for this gene before administering to their patients. So I think, again, there are obviously a risk with any sort of medication that you take.
Yeah.
And it is just with that pinch of salt that, you know, you trust and do what you can.
And that's why we need the studies to find actually what's the percentage of success and the percentage of risk.
Uh-huh.
When it comes to any drug. And just to finish off with this disease-modifying drugs, there are some tau targeting, which is another protein, drugs like gosuranemab and tilavoremab, which are tau targeting drugs, and they're basically doing the same as the amyloid targeting antibodies, but for tauopathies like CTE. So as we're talking about the concerns and the post-marketing studies for these drugs, it's good to have some information about regulatory approval when it comes to any drug. So regulatory approval is known to be a rigorous process. With the UK, it is having a large focus in cost effectiveness. But let's start talking about the US Regulatory Approval Administration, the FDA, food, or in other words, the Food and Drug Administration. They have a three-phase testing process for drugs which lasts about 10 years, but if effectiveness is proven early, there can be accelerated approval for a drug. And as we talked about, a phase four testing process takes place, which is essentially post-marketing studies. So any studies taking place about the safety or the how a drug, how effective it is, for example, that take place after the drug has been available in the market. For example, the ARIA effect we talked about. In the UK, there are two administrations. Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, or MHRA, which is the counterpart to the US's FDA. And the UK has another administration as well, which evaluates the cost effectiveness of a drug, the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence, or NICE. When we say cost effectiveness, it means that when the NHS wants to adopt a therapy or anything really, there has to be a weighing of benefit to cost. And if the cost is deemed greater than the benefit of any therapy, and this could be due to the therapy itself being too costly, or the NHS having to make the proper preparations to adapt to any therapy, because maybe some therapy requires a specific kind of space, a specific kind of specialization.
Equipment,
yeah. That's when, that's basically what we mean by cost effectiveness and if the benefit is worth the cost. And of course, well, I would imagine that the longer something is out, like a treatment, and the longer the medical community adapts to it, then it becomes more cost effective. For antibody treatments, for example, there is high cost, and there's specialized delivery. So the UK might not get this kind of therapy soon, because the question is if the benefits outweigh this huge cost of the specialized delivery. But why is this delivery so special? It's this kind of drugs are administered by drip, which is costly, and it's done once a month. Which means that there needs to be a dedicated space and the dedicated amount of time to for this process to happen.
And I feel like instead of, you know, investing all that money into building in the infrastructure and needed equipment for all this pharmaceutical administration, the NHS would be more happier to, or it'd make more sense for the NHS to reinvest that money into social environments where it's Alzheimer's and dementia patient friendly, or people with that disability friendly, especially you know, investing more money into groups that support these patients by, like, for aforementioned the group activities, like the music stuff, the anything cognitively stimulating. And it would make more sense for them to give that a shot. And I feel like that's something that we want to achieve with our project, or with our idea, is that if we give the government an opportunity to see that, you know, we can do earlier detection through like our screening test, then there won't be much need for these very highly effective drugs to be administered in the later stages, when there could be some social and environmental changes in the beginning, once this person knows that they might potentially have Alzheimer's or dementia, they can go through the support groups and have, like, you know, an environment where they know, like, okay, I'm not seen as an outside person, I'm not cast out of the society, I still have things that support me. And it's at most important that governments, you know, invest the money for that.
Yeah, and with earlier intervention, like earlier detection, one could make the case that even these drugs that are successful in the later stages, even the disease-modifying drugs, they have greater margin for success if they're applied in the early stages. So their effectiveness goes higher,
mm-hmm.
while the cost remains the same. And with having earlier detection, a pathway, as we discussed earlier in the episode, for someone, a treatment pathway, could be standardized, so both the NHS and the patient could be sure in how they're going to be treated and make the maybe correct financial decisions, financial security decisions, to be able to accommodate for this.
Yeah, I just want to take this time to just bring up a document that was posted by Alzheimer's Society in partnership with a company called CF, I want to say, I'm not sure, but the whole point of the document was to kind of give people an insight on what the costs are for Alzheimer's care and, you know, taking care of our patients. And one of the biggest costs, or where they feel like would improve, or, you know, cut down costs, is to improve early and accurate diagnosis. So less than 65% of people with dementia are diagnosed, most without confirmatory testing. So if we improve screening to identify more cases earlier, we could reduce the costs that are associated with the further treatments, you know, down the line.
So from this, one can see how the more information we have about Alzheimer's, the better equipped we get to face it. And this is why federations such as ADI all push for that sort of mindset that allows people to just be open to more knowledge, rather than just dismissing something as something that might happen, something that's part of growing older, Alzheimer's. But when you see it as the disease it is, then you're in the right mindset to want to learn about it and learn about all these ways it can be prevented, the ways it can be treated, and why these are important.
I think this episode is a good reminder for everyone to go through all the social media posts with the hashtags #AskAboutDementia, #AskAboutAlzheimer's. As you know, it helps us understand what we can do as a society to make these individuals feel like you know, they're still part of society and they don't feel excluded or they're not getting enough support that they require. And also this kind of cements the need for why we need that early screening tests. So the more support or the more time that these patients get, the better the support can be, the better the treatments can be, the more effective the treatments can be.
Yeah, we feel like that the sooner the support arrives to an individual, the better the outcome may be. Yeah, I think that's it for this episode. We hope you liked it. If you have any questions, you can contact us at contact@scenewave.co.uk.
And I think if you guys have any other science-based topics to start or that you want us to
discuss,
have a read, please do send them across. From now onwards, that's kind of what we're looking to do with the podcast. We've spent some time giving you guys an idea of what our project is, what Alzheimer's is about, what are the different neurodegenerative diseases, what, you know, what can you do as a lifestyle change, or the possible drugs, etc. These are all covered in the previous episodes. From going onwards, we will be covering various science-based topics. We will be touching back every now and then to Alzheimer's and, you know, what is in the current research. But if you guys have something specific that you'd like us to go over in the podcast, please do send them at the contact email, or you know, you can reach out to us on our Instagram. I don't think there's anything else for us to talk about.
Yeah, for today. And keep an eye out, because we're planning some interviews for the near future. So thank you for your attention, and see you next time.